whatever we do, we'll do together for sure.
The lieutenant governor says he and the governor will run again, but there's still uncertainty. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, celebrating a big run of sockeye for Bristol Bay.
Everybody's got a lot of money to spend in that and ramp up for that. It's good times for Bristol Bay right now.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided in all the training programs, from accounting services to security and protective services. Tweet hashtag CareersBeginHere to learn more. This message is sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
If any harsh words were spoken last week, Senator Lisa Murkowski appears to have patched things up with Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. Last week, Zinke called both Alaska senators to tell them the president was not pleased with Murkowski's vote against Republican health care efforts. Senator Dan Sullivan told the Alaska Dispatch News that Zinke's message was pretty clear, and Sullivan said it caused him to fear for Alaska's resource development agenda. Murkowski and Zinke both told reporters later there were no threats, but for what it's worth, on the same afternoon of the phone calls, Murkowski hastily canceled a hearing on three Interior Department nominees. Fast forward to today. Zinke tweeted a picture of himself and Murkowski having beers together, two Alaskan brewing company pale ales, along with a chummy message calling Murkowski a friend. Coincidence or not, Murkowski rescheduled the canceled Energy Committee meeting today and advanced the three nominees. Lieutenant Governor Byron Malotte said yesterday that he and Governor Bill Walker will run for re-election next year, and he says they'll run together. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on why, even for incumbents, that may be an uphill fight.
Byron Malotte went further than Walker has in talking about next year's election. He spoke to host Pete Caron on Juneau radio station KINY.
Well, we have both decided that we will run again.
Malotte says the decision isn't absolute because they don't know what may occur in the future. But he says their minds are made up to run again.
Whatever we do, we'll do together, for sure.
Walker is a former Republican who ran without party affiliation in 2014. Malotte is a longtime Democrat who won the party's nomination for governor that year. Malotte then decided to join Walker's ticket. Malotte didn't say whether he and Walker will seek the nomination of a political party, but he noted that their non-affiliated run last time was successful. Walker's political spokeswoman is his daughter, Lindsay Hobson. She declined to comment on whether Walker is running for re-election, but she may have confirmed a re-election campaign in a roundabout way. She said she isn't saying that Malotte was inaccurate. Malotte's comments were received warmly by Alaska Republican Party Chairman Tuckerman Babcock.
We are happy to have our candidate take on two Democrats, and we think Governor Walker represents Democrats, and we think the Democratic Party will get its act together and also have a upfront Democrat. So from our perspective, having two Democrats running is a good thing.
Walker faces a potential challenge. If there is a Democrat running separately on the ballot, those votes would likely come at his cost. Babcock says he doesn't think it's possible for Walker to run as a Republican.
I don't see any avenue for Bill Walker to try to run in the Republican primary. I mean, he's governed as a Democrat with Democrat policies and Democratic appointments for the most part. And we see him as just a Democrat in independent clothing.
The Republicans may have a large field. While Wasilla State Senator Mike Dunleavy is the only announced candidate, former Senators John Binkley and Charlie Huggins, former Lieutenant Governor Lauren Lehman, and businessmen Bob Gillum and Scott Hawkins have met with party insiders about possible campaigns. The Alaska Democratic Party endorsed Walker 4 years ago. The party's executive director, Jay Parmley, says he wasn't surprised by Malotte's comments. Parmley says the party hasn't talked with Walker and Malott about how they would run.
And we will cross that bridge whenever there is a complete formal announcement and the governor and lieutenant governor both declare their complete intentions as to the way they are choosing to move forward.
Parmley says Babcock shouldn't be focused on who will run against the Republican candidate.
I'm not concerned about who the Republicans are going to nominate. It's going to be, in my view, a sort of a clown parade on that side.
Parmley says he's not concerned that both Walker and a Democrat will appear on the ballot.
The reason I'm not concerned about anything is because it's not a reality. I mean, it's the fact of the matter is that the governor and lieutenant governor are going to make a decision. We may have other Democrats who make a decision, and we will work all of that through as we go.
A major unknown on the Democratic side is whether former U.S. Senator Mark Begich will run. The filing deadline for the primaries is June 1st, almost 10 months away. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Abortion rights advocates and the state of Alaska are seeking to dismiss a lawsuit after the state medical board adopted new regulations for abortions after the first trimester. Attorneys for Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest and the Hawaiian Islands and for the state jointly filed a motion asking a judge to dismiss the case that Planned Parenthood brought forward last year. Both sides say the new regulations render the lawsuit moot. Prodded by the lawsuit, the state medical board addressed provisions that Planned Parenthood challenged as outdated and unnecessary. That included getting rid of a requirement that two doctors weigh in when a woman wants an abortion after the first trimester. It appears that this year the Bristol Bay Sockeye Salmon Run has blown forecasts out of the water. The state's preliminary tally for this year's total run is just over $56 million. That's about 35% bigger than the preseason forecast. So far, the harvest now stands at 37.5 million fish, which is 10 million more than was expected. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more on the size of this year's run.
All of Bristol Bay's managed rivers have met or exceeded their escapement goals. Several district records were broken, and it seems quite a few fishermen logged their best seasons ever. Among those is Kurt Baumgart, who fishes the Rhine Bee in the Nooshigak District. He says he's not sure if he'll ever see another summer like 2017.
I'd like to. No, it was phenomenal. I've never seen that much fish in the Nooshigak ever, or anywhere in the bay. They're all the way from Schooner's Channel to West Channel, just anywhere you went, you could put your net out and load up. It's pretty impressive.
Baumgart is a 36-year veteran of Bristol Bay's fishery and is usually one of Trident Seafood's top boats. The number of pounds he and his crew put away this season is staggering, though he didn't want to let that be public for sake of it coming across as boastful. Baumgart hopes this extra harvest and higher base price is a rising tide that lifts all boats in Bristol Bay.
Oh, it's always good. It's good for everybody. It's great because we're going to the RSW required for everybody, so everybody's got a lot of money to spend in that and ramp up for that. It's good times for Bristol Bay right now.
This year's total run of 56.2 million sockeye appears to be the fourth largest on record since 1952, bested in size by 1980, 1995, and 2015. The harvest of 37.5 million sockeye is the fourth biggest of the bay's history, behind 1993, 95, and 2016. It's possible 2017 will edge past last year because, as ADF&G's Westside manager Tim Sands points out, the real final tally isn't quite complete.
We're still counting at Togiak, and you know there's still some fishing happening, and we'll get final numbers from fish tickets sometime this winter, but there shouldn't be any significant changes for sockeye numbers anyway.
The numbers could also be adjusted down a bit, too, when the state gets a better handle on how many chum were mixed in with this year's sockeye catch. That happens as processors supply final production numbers Fish and Game can compare back to the actual fish tickets. While most of the effort quickly dropped off last week, there is still some fishing in the bay, and there are still sockeye being landed. The east side districts are open on the fall schedule, and Sands has the Nooshigak district wide open till further notice.
At least a couple buyers out there, and then at least a couple kind of self-marketers, direct marketers as well. So there is some effort out there, 20 or 30 deliveries a day maybe, and a good half of those are setting it.
Sand says deliveries on Tuesday seem to be about half reds and half silvers. That will tilt more and more towards the coho each day. He says he can leave the fishery open because there is not enough effort on the west side to have an impact on the silver runs.
Most of these populations can sustain a harvest rate of at least 50%, and I don't think we're going to approach 50% with a couple dozen boats.
Bristol Bay's Ugashik, Igigik, and Nushagak districts all came in above their preseason forecasts. The Togiak district is a bit shy of its 660,000 fish forecast, but is still fishing and counting. The Naknek-Quijack district came up about a million fish short of the state's preseason forecast of 16.1 million. That district ran late as well, and interestingly, did count quite a few Quijack sockeye just before the tower came down on July 31st. That tower crew tallied a final 432,000 fish in its last week, putting the total Quijack sockeye escapement to 3.16 million. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the fishermen who tried to prevent an oil spill disaster in Prince William Sound.
Well, we call ourselves the Mighty 500. We probably didn't have a 500.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
In 1989, the Exxon Valdez oil tanker ran aground, spilling 11 million gallons of crude into Prince William Sound. We sometimes look back and see it as an unprecedented, unthinkable event. But in fact, people warned about it, and they tried to prevent it. Before the pipeline was even built, fishermen in Cordova fought to keep oil tankers out of the sound. This summer, Alaska's Energy Desk is bringing you a series called Midnight Oil, about the state's long and complicated love affair with the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Today, Rachel Waldholtz has the story of when the one thing fishermen worried would happen, happened.
20 years before the pipeline was even built, Ross Mullins was already warning about an oil spill in Prince William Sound. Mullins is in his 80s now. He lives surrounded by history. Literally, his house in Cordova is piled with stuff. In the kitchen, he's watching a YouTube tutorial on mixing your own flavors of vaping fluid.
This is my favorite at the moment. It's Rakuki. It's made as raspberry, cucumber, and kiwi.
Mullins came up to Cordova from the Bay Area in the early 60s. He was a hippie and a photographer. He didn't mean to stay, but he got sucked into fishing. And when he first heard the plans for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline to end in Valdez, he says he saw the risk right away. In the 60s and 70s, there was a series of well-publicized oil spills all over the world. Mullins says he knew that if Alaska's oil was transported by tanker, a disaster was inevitable. So he rallied the local fishermen's union, and they levied a penny per fish tax on themselves to hire a law firm and challenge the pipeline in 1971.
Well, we called ourselves the Mighty 500. We probably didn't have a 500.
But they went up against the oil industry and the state, and they won. Their lawsuit, along with one from national environmental groups, halted the pipeline. Their victory was short-lived. In 1973, Congress exempted the pipeline from the lawsuits. So Mullins and the fishermen switched gears. They pushed for the highest safety standards possible. He remembers one trip to D.C., standing in Senator Ted Stevens' office.
Well, one of the things I remember distinctly him saying was, "I can assure you that not one drop of oil will touch the waters of Prince William Sound."
It was one of many promises made in the 70s as lawmakers and industry tried to get the pipeline moving. They promised that tankers operating in Prince William Sound would have double hulls, and they promised a state-of-the-art system to track vessels through the sound and a world-class oil spill response system. But one by one, the promises made by industry, the state, and the federal government failed to materialize. or the safeguards simply eroded. In the end, the system failed more quickly than even Mullins had imagined it could.
It was a hell of a lot sooner than I thought it would be. I mean, the oil had only been going through the pipe for 12 years or whatever, and you know, that's not a long time for something that's supposed to be state-of-the-art to function.
Flying over the Sound today, the pilot points out a white and red navigational marker sticking up out of an unassuming patch of water. From 1,000 feet up, it doesn't look any bigger than a camera tripod.
You see this post right here? That's Bly Reef. That's where the Exxon Valdez ran aground.
In the distance are the icebergs calving off the giant Columbia Glacier. It was these same chunks of ice that the Exxon Valdez was trying to avoid when it collided with Bly Reef. This is the spot where all systems failed. The tanker's crew made a series of inexplicable mistakes. The captain had been drinking that night and left an overtired third mate in charge. Inadequate tracking didn't pick up the ship as it headed off course, and the shallow reef sheared right through the tanker's single hull. Today, things have changed. Congress passed a raft of reforms after the Exxon Valdez. Things like requiring new tankers to have double hulls, better vessel tracking, and escort tugboats. Prince William Sound is now guarded by an elaborate system to prevent future spills. But for years, the Exxon Valdez loomed over the fishing town of Cordova like a dark shadow. The spill coincided with plunging fish prices, and in the 90s, the town dropped into a depression. People lost their boats. They lost their livelihoods. Many worried there was no future for Cordova. Today, that fear is lifting. There's a whole new generation of fishermen. They were just kids during the spill. Like Mike Mickelson. He was 5 when the tanker struck Bly Reef.
Most of us, if not all of us, got told in school, well, whatever you do, don't go fishing and go to college and make something of yourself. And everybody went to college and quite a few of us came back and bought into fishing. So.
Today, he owns 2 fishing boats. And now he says there's a community of young people, all taking a chance on Prince William Sound. It's a big chance. Getting into fishing means taking out a loan to buy a permit and another loan to buy a boat.
I had a couple friends that talked me into buying into sailing. It's like, oh, yeah, hundreds of thousands of dollars, no problem. You'll be fine. And it's been a hard road, but you know, I'm going to make it. And that's the great thing.
Mickelson and his peers are making a big commitment to this place. It's a bet that fishermen can still make a living in Cordova, and that there won't be another Exxon Valdez. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage. This story was co-produced with Jennifer Pemberton.
This story was adapted from Alaska Energy Desk's podcast called Midnight Oil. Episode 7 has the full story of the Exxon Valdez oil spill told by the fishermen of Prince William Sound. To hear this and other stories in the series, go to alaskapublic.org or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Climate change may be responsible for pushing Alaska's gray whales up into estuaries and rivers like the Kuskokwim. Oregon-based whale biologist Dr. Carrie Newell says gray whales spend 6 months of the year in Alaskan waters feeding, digging into the muddy bottoms of the North Pacific, Bering Sea, and Arctic Ocean, looking for tiny shelled creatures known as amphipods.
They're about 1/2 inch to 1 inch long. The grays need to eat about a ton of those a day.
Alaskan waters have warmed significantly with climate change, and one result is less of these cold water-loving crustaceans to feed gray whales, which sends the inquisitive whales into new habitat, looking for food. This could be the reason, Newell says, why the whale went 60 miles up the Kuskokwim.
I know that up in Alaska, the gray whales are not doing nearly as well as they are down here for food. And so maybe it was trying to look for a new source of food because the food, the amphipods they primarily have fed on up in Alaska, have not been doing as well as they have in the past.
In other words, the whale may have been hungry. She says it was probably a male, and at 37 feet, it weighed probably 37 tons. Most of the East Pacific gray whales spend their summers in Alaska eating and their winters in Mexico off the Baja Peninsula, breeding and calving. Human-polar bear interactions are part of life in Arctic communities, but as melting sea ice forces polar bears onto dry land, they're becoming more common and potentially more dangerous. This is the message of a recent scientific paper. Carter Barrett talked to one of the researchers and someone on the ground in an Arctic village that will be affected.
In Halloween of 2014, the kids at the village of Arviat in the Canadian Arctic had to trick-or-treat indoors. In the community center, they had a warm place to show off their costumes. But more importantly, they were safe from three polar bears outside. That night, a polar bear and her two yearlings spent 3 hours on the outskirts of town trying to find a way in. The polar bear patrol used four-wheelers and bright lights to try to keep the bears from getting too close to town. Elizabeth Kruger with the World Wildlife Fund was there that night.
And so the bears would go a bit out on the ice, and then they would just wait for the four-wheelers to go away, and then they'd come back on shore and try to cause trouble.
Jim Wilder, the polar bear project leader for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Anchorage, recently published a paper on how climate change is impacting polar bear behavior.
So when they have less opportunity to hunt, obviously that has impacts to their body condition. So the bears become thinner, skinnier. And what our study has shown actually is when polar bears become thinner and skinnier, they become a little more aggressive in their pursuit of feeding opportunities.
The study is a first of its kind, combining research from the United States, Norway, Canada, Greenland, and Russia to look at what motivates polar bears to attack humans. Polar bears usually hunt on the sea ice, stalking unsuspecting seals. But when there's open water where there used to be ice, the bears are forced onto land. Wilder's study found when bears are thinner and desperate, they also become more aggressive hunters. For evidence of this, the paper points to the worst years on record for polar bear attacks, 2010 to 2014, a period of historically low summer sea ice.
You know, bears in general, and particularly polar bears, make their living by investigating anomalies on the landscape, you know, something that might indicate there's something there to eat.
That used to mean places in the ice that indicated there were seals. But now, small coastal communities on the flat tundra landscape can also look attractive to the bears. Wilder says not to panic. There have only been 6 recorded polar bear attacks in the last 145 years in Alaska. But there's still cause for concern.
If I lived in a coastal community, I would be concerned about the loss of sea ice and the impact of that to polar bears.
A majority of bears that attacked people were malnourished. Part of Elizabeth Kruger's job is advising small communities on the best way to keep polar bears out of town.
One thing that I hear really often in the villages is people saying, you know, we've been here for millennia and we're a pretty resilient people and we'll get through this. And I have seen how people live, and I don't doubt that they will get through it. That said, this is something we haven't seen before, and it is going to cause drastic changes no matter what we do.
In order to prepare for increased interactions between polar bears and humans, Wilder's study mentions Arctic residents should learn to recognize malnourished bears, manage their trash properly, and if it comes down to it, know how to use a firearm. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Carter Barrett in Juneau.
National Weather Service climate expert Rick Toman says there's a good chance that all of Alaska will likely be warmer than normal this month and the next couple of months. But he says there's near certainty that coastal areas along the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering and Beaufort Seas will be warm through October. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Toman says the computer models and array of sensors that he and other climate experts use to develop long-term forecasts suggest there's a 45% chance that the eastern and central interior will be warmer than normal through October. He says that's a statewide trend that's developed in recent years.
The early autumn season over most of the state, except for southeast, in the last decade, there's been really quite a strong trend for a warm early autumn season.
But Toman says the models show an especially strong likelihood of warmer than normal temperatures in coastal areas through late summer and early fall. He says that's mainly due to warm sea surface temperatures and the absence of sea ice in the Bering and Beaufort Seas.
Especially over western and northern Alaska, very low sea ice cover. The ice cover left very early, even by modern standards, across the North Slope.
Toman says when Arctic sea ice cover retreats northward to its so-called minimum extent sometime in September, it probably won't break the minimum extent record set in 2012. But he says years of warming in the Arctic make it certain that it'll be near the top of the list.
It's not a question of, is it going to be above or below normal? The only real question is, will it be the lowest? Will it be the second lowest? Will it be the third lowest?
Toman says precipitation is harder to predict a month out than it is for temperatures, but he says the models suggest near normal precipitation throughout much of the state through October, except along the Bering Sea coast and southeast Alaska, where higher than normal precipitation is likely. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
And unseasonably warm weather is coming for South Central Alaska just in time for the weekend. That's according to the National Weather Service, which issued a special statement forecasting clear skies, sun, and temperatures in the high 70s or low 80s by Saturday. Here's meteorologist Dave Percy.
It's a highlight for a pattern change in the weather from the cloudy, wet weather we've had, you know, for the last few days and today, and then start turning sunny and warmer tomorrow afternoon, especially on Saturday.
The weather statement prompted the Anchorage Office of Emergency Management to issue an advisory saying to, quote, take appropriate precautions that spark some amusement and derision among residents. Percy says the original statement was only intended to let people know about the drastic, if welcome, change in weather.
That was their take on it. You know, the headline, we had warm, sunny weather coming to South Central Alaska Friday and Saturday. That's what this office put out.
Rain showers are back in the forecast for late Sunday, Monday, and the rest of next week. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. Read reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman and Carter Barrett in Juneau, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Rachel Waldholz and Casey Grove in Anchorage, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Zachariah Hughes produced tonight's program. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Midnight Oil is brought to you with generous support from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.